This is special programming from North State Public Radio. I'm Sarah Bohannon. Tonight on After Paradise, it's been 6 weeks since the campfire started. Tonight, we hear about an investigation into why emergency alerts failed as the fire was unfolding. Plus, we check in with a detective about where the three people left on the missing persons list may be. And the Butte County Superintendent of Schools talks about what's next for students as they depart for a tough holiday break. We want to hear your questions and comments. Leave a message for us at 433-4887 or on our website, mynspr.org. For Thursday, December 20th, 2018, this is After Paradise. There has been a lot of news the past few days. I sat down in the studio with NSPR reporter Mark Albert to get the latest. Looking at the major news of this week, there was an announcement that much of what was being called non-hazardous waste, that's uncontaminated metal and concrete debris, would be processed in Chico, possibly in the Barber neighborhood, but that's changed.
Yes, absolutely. There was a lot of opposition to that plan, which FEMA and Cal OES presented as almost a fait accompli. But they have said over and over again that the local authorities were going to be driving every decision and that the state and federal officials were there to help. And apparently they've relented and they've taken that site off the table. Very similar thing with the potential to house 250 families in North Chico, where there was great amount of opposition as well. The landlord or the owner of that property apparently has dropped out of negotiations with FEMA, and that site is also off the table. However, FEMA and Cal OES remain committed to getting people into interim housing. They've just announced a deal where 350 trailers will be placed in Gridley, so at least there's some progress on that front.
And last weekend, all of the evacuation orders were lifted in Paradise. I know that you were back in Paradise yesterday, where people are starting to return. What's it like and how are people functioning?
Well, you know, it's very different from immediately after the fire. The air is clear. The number of utility trucks is very much declined. The power lines are in for the most part, but the devastation remains. It is unreal and of a scale, if you haven't been there, really impossible to imagine. People are returning, and there's really a range of emotions. Folks have been scattered across the region. I talked to one woman who, with her family and several animals, were in a motel room in Anderson for over a month. They've now transitioned to a trailer in Durham. I spoke to another woman who ran a hair salon. She's not exactly sure what their plans are. Her husband's job is still here, but the only aid really available to them is an SBA loan. Another person I spoke to, George Magpusau, who operated Via Sierra, a home for developmentally disabled adults, he said he's determined to come back.
My plans are in that area there that I have, I want to build apartment units and then a house in the back for my wife and I. We're coming back. I mean, no matter what, we're coming back.
Another person I met yesterday, Jasana Levitsky, she said her farm and her home were absolutely destroyed. Her family has faced a tremendous amount of uncertainty. They were unable to secure any rentals in the region. They actually are just closing on a property in Corning, she said. They seem very conflicted.
The plan is to hold on to the property here in Paradise and, you know, remediate the soil and clean up as much as we can, and when we can rebuild something maybe small on the property.
For the most part, the people that I spoke to, they are saying that the insurance companies are treating them pretty well, that they're getting cash flow, that they're working with FEMA. The community is still in shock and coming to grips with this tremendous loss. It's not entirely clear what shape Paradise will take as the reconstruction gets underway, and it still seems quite a ways off.
All right. Well, thank you so much for the update, Mark.
You're welcome.
Looking at other campfire-related news this week, the Paradise Irrigation District has resumed water service to 127 streets in town, but officials are not sure if that water is safe. At a meeting last night in Durham, officials said that while the campfire may have spared the town's actual watershed, the fire may have been so hot that it melted some of the water system's plastic pipes. That may have released chemicals like benzene into the water supply. Jim Passanisi is Paradise's water treatment superintendent. He said this happened in the Tubbs Fire last year.
The same sort of things that Santa Rosa did to resolve this, this district would do. So the plastic water services that melted, you have to replace the water services.
PID is not sure if this has actually happened in Paradise. Officials tested for benzene and other chemicals yesterday and will notify the public as soon as they get the results back. Paradise's water is also under a boil notice, but Passanisi stressed that boiling your water gets rid of bacteria, not chemicals like benzene. So at this point, the safest bet is to not drink any Paradise water, boiled or not. One of the biggest questions officials are facing in the aftermath of this disaster is why so many people never received warnings as the fire raged toward Paradise, Concow, and Magalia, even people who had signed up to receive them. This week, the San Jose Mercury News published a detailed report looking into that question. NSPR's Tess Vigeland spoke with science reporter Lisa Krieger about the investigation.
Lisa Krieger, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Explain for us what records you asked for here and give us an overview of what you found.
While the fire was burning, we kept hearing reports from people saying, we didn't get warning, we didn't get warning, we signed up for warning, we didn't get warning. I filed a Public Records Act request with Butte County for the records that the county released, the Sheriff's Department, as well as the Chico Police Department and the Paradise Police Department. There were 28 alerts sent to probably 30 or 40 evacuation zones time-stamped. And these reports also told us how many calls went through, phone calls, how many calls went through, and how many did not go through, how many did not connect with an actual telephone.
And what did you find?
It was stunning. There were places where close to 90% of the red, it's called Code Red, alerts did not reach a telephone. There are other parts of the city where they were very effective, and maybe 20-25% did not go through. And something like 17,000 calls did reach a telephone, but something like 11,000 never connected at all. So these are people who thought they would be warned, and they weren't. These are people who registered for the system. Now, 3/4 of the population of Paradise had not registered for the system, and that's a whole other problem. But our story was very broad, and it was looking at when people didn't learn about the fire, why was that? And basically, there are three different categories. There were human errors, and that is people didn't sign up for the system. There are also problems executing this alert system, that there were whole zones that got missed. There were also technical problems in that cell towers went down. And then the third factor, of course, which we're aware of, and that's Mother Nature. And you can have a great plan, but unless there's just a button you can push and put it all in place, when a fire is moving that fast, things don't go the way you hope.
Another part of your article talks about why it's so difficult to figure this out from county to county, and it's because all of the counties in the state have different systems. And now, we've talked before on the program about two of the major systems that are used, both Code Red and something called WEA. Can you take us through each of those briefly? And then why is it that counties are responsible for figuring out what system they're going to use?
We can think of it in terms of two major types of systems. One is this government emergency alert system, or WEA, which is the wireless emergency alerts. And people are familiar with those through the Amber alerts that we get. And then there's a second system, and these are the commercial notification systems. So that's what Code Red is. There's a company called Everbridge. These are purchased by the counties. And the WEA alerts, they're fairly limited right now. There are only 90 characters that you can issue. And those of us who have seen them, you see it's very limited, the amount of information you get. So you really can't tell people, you know, there's a fire in the west, there's a fire in the southeast, evacuate on Route 7. However, you can't offer that kind of detailed information. They also tend to blanket very large areas. So, and this was a concern in Paradise. They didn't want all of Butte County, you know, with Gridley and Chico and everyone else, panicking over a fire that was very specific to Concal and Paradise and Magalia. That will improve in 2019. They'll expand the number of characters to 360, and then they'll get better at targeting geographic areas. The second system, and you mentioned with Code Red and Everbridge, these are purchased by the counties. And what they let local officials do is send messages to landlines or cell phones or email addresses or text messages. And they are very targeted. You know, they can specify for your zone that you need to evacuate, but maybe the zone right next to you doesn't need to evacuate. The key difference between these two also is that the WEA alert does not require registration. You don't have to sign up for it. If you've got a cell phone, you will get it. It'll find you. The commercial systems do need people to sign up. And there's been a challenge because we just really haven't gotten the enrollment that we need to.
So how do counties decide what they're going to use?
It's very much ad hoc. And this gets to the challenge we have regionally. And in fact, what someone I interviewed talked about how these different systems are sort of duct taped together. We have 58, each county has its own system duct taped together for the entire state.
That can't be anything but disconcerting to citizens of any county to hear that disaster communications is held together by duct tape.
I find it completely unsettling. We have this very sophisticated society and very interactive, very much connected to each other, depending on this, on electronics, essentially, and the effectiveness of electronics. And it's very disconcerting.
Yeah, you talk with anyone from Magalia, Concal, and Paradise, and they say that people knocking on doors are what saved lives in this fire.
Exactly. Human to human.
Lisa, what did the authorities say in response to your findings?
They have not responded specifically because they, to be honest, haven't had their time to do their own analysis. And they will do an analysis, and I'm sure it'll be thorough. Sheriff of Butte County did express some regret and remorse that he wished he had had the opportunity to get more alerts out, more warning out. And in some ways, they were really betrayed by the technology and the towers going out and the inability of the messages to get where they needed to go.
Lisa Krieger is a science writer with the San Jose Mercury News. Lisa, thank you so much for your reporting.
Tess, it's been a pleasure.
That was NSPR's Tess Vigeland speaking with science reporter Lisa Krieger. You're listening to After Paradise, a special production from North State Public Radio. More just ahead. This is After Paradise, a special program on the aftermath of the Camp Fire from North State Public Radio. I'm Sarah Bohannon. Families and friends of the missing faced agony over the last few weeks. The process of finding and locating those on the missing persons list captivated the nation as the number swung dramatically after the first days of the fire. At one point, it contained more than 1,000 names. Now it's down to just three: Sarah Fabula Martinez, John Demianew, and Wendy Krug. NSPR's Mark Albert talked to Detective Jake Smith of the Butte County Sheriff's Office about the continued search. He started by asking how Smith's team could even tackle a list that was so long in the early days after the fire.
that was kind of one of the issues, is that, you know, you have to keep pushing forward. And so we didn't know how big it was until we really started looking at numbers. There was so much information that we couldn't even process it fast enough, because we had emails, we had a call center going. So we were just getting so much information in. We didn't even know what all we had until it took days to kind of to look at everything and see, you know, who was what, because we had so many duplicate names called in. It was a big task.
And there were people who were reported missing that weren't missing, and then a lot of that was resolved.
That's correct. One of the big issues that we had was that we had a lot of folks calling in that hadn't had contact with people in a long time. They didn't know how to spell their names. They didn't know where they lived. They didn't have good information. And so one of the problems that we had was duplicate names. So if there was a name misspelled, it would cause a couple duplicate entries. And it took a lot of time and data processing just to get those numbers resolved down to where we figured out, okay, these five people are actually one singular person.
The list has been shortened, and now it's down to three.
That's correct. We have three people that are left on our list of people that got called in about. These three have been hard to find. In our investigation, we found that these three, didn't have a set address. They were either in between houses or didn't have a defined address. In some aspects, they were transient. So that's made it difficult to follow up on them. Through our continuing investigation, one of them, I believe, absolutely made it out of the fire, because I have some good information that she had tried to check in at a hotel. We just haven't been able to locate her in person to talk to her. And the other two, we don't have very many contacts or good contact information for them. To me, it doesn't seem as though these people necessarily died in the fire, but maybe they're just hard to track down. That they're more than likely going to get contacted by law enforcement, or one of their family members will finally hear from them and then hopefully communicate back to us. It's difficult to find people. One of these folks has a warrant for their arrest. They may not want to be contacted. And that's another option to think about, is that these folks may not want to be contacted by law enforcement. They may not want to be contacted by their family members. There may be some reasons why they don't want to be found, so to speak.
What's the process if they never turn up? I mean, how many months or years is it before they're declared deceased?
They'll stay a missing person until they're located. So we have requirements that we have as far as missing persons reports and missing persons investigations go. At some point in time, we need to get DNA, a reference sample from a family member, to the Department of Justice. That way we can, if remains are found that are unidentified, we could close that gap or close that loop. So there are certain steps that we have to go through, as with any missing persons case. Having worked missing persons cases a lot in my career, the progression is usually we do all the basic investigation that we can, try to find these people, and then we just rely on them to turn up. And if something really bad did happen to these folks, we do need to find out who last spoke to them, where they were last seen, to try to narrow our search efforts down. So we are still looking for them. I don't want to make it sound as though we're just waiting until they get found, but it's difficult. You know, a lot of the times it's hard to track down who last saw somebody, especially when there's a big gap in time when they haven't talked to their family members.
Can you share anything about some of the cases that were difficult to solve that were solved?
The majority of the people that were displaced checked in with the Red Cross in some fashion, but some of them went completely out of the area. So we had folks that were located in Chester. I think one couple got located in Southern California. We had a lot of people several that got located by their family members by seeing them on the news. We had 30 plus detectives for a while all working on these simultaneously. And a lot of it came down to just making phone calls to family and friends to see who had heard from them. I remember specifically a guy, he was supposed to evacuate with his family, did not evacuate with his family. They called to have him checked on. Turned out the house didn't burn. We sent a deputy up there and he was fine. He didn't want to leave. He was okay. And they had a separate house where they had some animals that needed to be checked on. So a deputy went and gave the guy a ride to his other house so he could check on the birds. And it turned into be a happy story, so it was good.
Thousands of Butte County families are bracing for a tough holiday season this year. Parents have been scrambling to figure out basic needs like clothing and housing, and driving long distances to get their children to school. Christmas shopping is the last thing on many people's minds. Earlier this week, a group of volunteers set up decorations and presents at a church in South Oroville to make sure kids displaced by the fire had something to celebrate. Teresa Katsourilis reports.
It's a cloudy afternoon, and the winter wonderland is slowly starting to fill up. A group of energetic volunteers in elf hats usher several toddlers through the doors of the Father's House Church.
Let's go say hi to Santa Claus.
The kids enter a maze of evergreen archways and Christmas lights. Precious Pike and Jeremy Dillon are standing by a cookie decorating station with their family. They lost their home in the campfire, they say, and are currently living in an RV with Dillon's grandmother. But Precious says they've already been able to replace a lot of what they lost through donations. She actually heard about this through a donation center.
I didn't expect it to be like this with all the Santa Claus, the pictures, the crafts.
She added that she's impressed by how joyful the giveaway was. The Winter Wonderland is part of the Gift of Hope, an annual Christmas assistance program run by the Father's House Church. For the past 14 years, the church has organized gift giveaways for hundreds of underprivileged children throughout Oroville and Butte County. Parishioners were prepared to give 1,000 children Christmas presents this year, but that was before the fire started.
We have members in our congregation that lost their homes. So yeah, there's quite a few people that we know that lost everything.
Danielle Devine is a pastor at the Father's House. She says after the fire, volunteers rallied quickly and registered an additional 1,000 children who were displaced, then bought each of them personalized presents.
We found out that Baby Alive is a big deal. LOL dolls, those are a big deal. But yeah, well, you know, the typical bikes, video game stuff.
Devine says the Father's House is giving presents to a total of 2,000 children, and they managed to pull it all off in about 4 weeks. The community is worried about what comes next, Devine says. Parishioners are trying to look ahead towards longer-term problems.
The housing crisis can't be understated. Butte County only had 1% housing available before the fire, and so now we have this really catastrophic event that have left so many people homeless.
But for now, the kids who survived the campfire are busy getting their presents at the end of the Winter Wonderland. The Father's House congregation is also giving away free shoes, diapers, and slow cookers, anything else fire survivors might need.
Oh, my word. What do you say? Thank you.
Reporting in South Oroville, I'm Teresa Kotsarillis.
Yesterday was the last day of school for kids across Butte County before they headed into holiday break. We continue with more from Teresa Kotsarillis, who interviewed County Superintendent of Schools Tim Taylor earlier this week. She asked him to reflect on the biggest challenges after the fire and on how students and teachers are doing since joining new classrooms across the county.
I think the biggest logistical challenge was that all of us, especially the Paradise District and the Charters and Concow and upper part of Chico, those leaders were very traumatized themselves. So even myself, having been right in the heart of this thing, and our command center was within a quarter mile of where all the fire trucks were. So you have 2,500 fire trucks going. You have the fire still burning. We all melted down after about 3 or 4 days. And what saved us was we brought in specialists who had no real skin in the game. They weren't tied to any lost homes or anything. So personally, our county office brought in about 9 people. The districts and charters brought in people because we had trouble making a decision of foot in front of us because this was so out of our league. And then the real benefit was within about 3 or 4 days, we started modeling and getting trained by the first responders how to run incident command meetings, how to make decisions. So that was number one. Number two, obviously, I think getting a week or two into where do you find space for 4,500 kids and where are they all? How are they doing? How's the staff doing? So the logistics around getting a school sites was difficult. Again, districts stepped up, Oroville and Durham. And Chico offered as much as they could and were backfilling the others. So that's a logistical nightmare. And then I think the very last piece is how do you get things back to normalcy? And you have your curriculum you have to do and you have state testing still and all that. But how do you get back to normalcy? Because teachers and kids love routine, so they're not in the same school they were in. They don't even have the same bulletin boards that are burned down or caught up there. And that took a lot of work, and we're still not there. I think the kids need to have that routine, which we hope we start to get to more so in January.
Of those 4,700 students, do you know how many haven't returned
Well, we think 55% have. About 1,500 have not, and they're spread out. And again, somewhat of a moving target. They're in local counties right around here. Some have left the state. You know, some have said this is too much. So that's a ever flowing chart.
How have the challenges that you guys are facing, how have those challenges changed?
Well, again, I think the biggest change is we have to get these portables in so the teachers have better teaching environments. I think all of us can do a temporary 2 or 3 week run. One of them's above a church. We have a kindergarten program over at Durham that has 60, 70 students in it with 5 teachers. We have to get them better environments so they can have a second semester that, like I told you, is more routine, and the teachers can get in their groove with them and feel like it's their home. So that's number one. I think number two is just constantly making sure the adults are supported and are provided their safety and their needs. I think I had a mom tell me the other day, Tim, quit saying the word trauma because you've been on so many newscasts and my kids are listening. So now they think they have a problem when they may not really have a problem. But when you keep saying you have a problem, then you have a problem. I'm using well-being because I think we all have trauma. We all have depression at some point. We all have the things we deal with. So I think that well-being's interest is going to be tough. I think it's a great opportunity for us to rethink and reinfuse more arts and culture and dance and music to all the kids. We've made some great strides up here. How do we get that? Because it makes kids feel great, and it makes them feel stronger and lets them express themselves and makes them feel well.
Do you happen to know what percentage of your students at this point are homeless or insecure in their housing at this point? And if you don't have an exact number, do you have an assumption?
Yeah, I mean, when we saw how many kids lost their homes or were displaced, 4,700, some are starting to go back to their homes up in Paradise, but that's an awkward thing because we have one school open up there and hopefully Pine Ridge too, but the majority of them are still have a home without a school or school without a home. So the numbers, it's a lot. I think it's probably in the 67% range of that 4,700. But the mayhem around that is intense because I think people have landed on some housing. It's different for them. I had somebody tell me the other day, where's the frogs, the crickets, the smell of pine? I'm in a nice townhome in Chico, and I can hear my neighbor in a wall next to me in a court full of cars. And I spent 3 minutes at a stoplight. And I'm just used to Paradise being more of the ridge. So those are really awkward things, I think, life-changing things, because I think people live in their homes and they miss the crickets and the frogs and the birds. Not that we don't have cricket and frogs, birds down in the valley too, but it's not like it is up there, and especially in their mind and to their kids' minds.
Do you have any concerns, or conversely, are you looking forward to the holidays this year?
Well, I think it's been an interesting couple of weeks because people have been so generous all throughout the country and world, and offered them so much. But I think for those of us that raise children, if you give them 10 gifts and then 11 and 12, how do you stop and step back and really appreciate what the holidays are for? And you can see and talk to a lot of parents, they're just really tired and they had to already shop a lot because they lost everything. So I think a lot of people are just looking for some peace and quiet. And I think a nice break and let them kind of rejuvenate and enjoy what they've got. And I told a lot of people the most powerful moments that I saw was that first day back at school and watching these parents who've been holding on to their children dearly for 3 weeks, leaving them at school and watching the couple go hand in hand or arm in arm, letting their children go back. It's like the first day of kindergarten, but probably even more intense. I think those parents are looking forward to some time back there, talk about the first couple weeks of school and their next steps, which are going to be, tough decisions ahead.
Butte County Superintendent Tim Taylor speaking with Teresa Katsourilis. And that's our program for Thursday, December 20th, 2018. We're produced by Mark Albert, Phil Wilkie, and Tess Figland. Adam Raguzia composed our theme music. Special thanks to Matt Fidler. The program airs each Thursday evening at 6:30. Thanks for being with us. I'm Sarah Bohannon, and this is After Paradise from North State Public Radio.